Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. All right, Gen X, Gen Y, Gen Z. If you're a baby boomer like me, you got confused about what generation was which when it got to millennials. I knew what the millennium was, but these kids were being called that before the millennium, so right away it got confusing. And our show today is about differences between those generations. So here's a little primer on it for those who don't know, which is most of us probably. Baby boomers were born between 1946 and 1964, which is quite a span of years, right? The oldest ones are old enough to, in some cases, to be the parents of the youngest ones. They're 18 years older. And today, the youngest ones in the baby boom are 57 years old, right? We won't talk about the oldest ones, some of whom are no longer with us. And next is Gen X, also known for a while as the Me Generation. And they were born between 1965 and 1980, a slightly shorter span of years. And today, they're middle-aged. The youngest ones are 41. Then there are the millennials, also known as Gen Y. That's where it gets confusing, right? So they were born between 1981 and 1996. So the youngest ones in Gen Y are now 25. And finally, I guess it's finally because we run out of letters unless they want to start over with Gen A or something. Finally, there's Gen Z, born between 1997 and 2015. Actually, I've heard that kids born after that might be called Zoomers, so I don't know if that'll stick or not. Seems kind of cleverish. But anyway, did you get all that? I hope so. And there'll be a quiz at the end of the show. All right, so what we have for your show today is three of us. Your host, me, a definite baby boomer. Dr. Mike Stump, a Gen X business owner and family man with a PhD in bioanalytics. And last but not least, Spencer Necessary, a young millennial or Gen Yer, who is a recent graduate of Virginia Tech with a degree in hospitality and tourism and is working at a country club in Tennessee, learning his profession in the real world. Welcome, guys.
Good to be here, Court.
Hey, good to be here, Court. Enjoy it. Thank you.
Yeah, good. Thanks for being on. So what I'd like to do, I think, is to break this down into categories and talk about maybe two topics during the show, since I think with three of us it's going to be hard to do more than half an hour than that. And then we can come back next week and talk about two more topics if you're up for it. Does that work?
Yeah, that works for me.
So today, why don't we talk about gender relations, and that includes marriage, and communication styles, those two topics. And those should definitely give us a lot to go on. I'll start, but this will be a conversation, so feel free to jump in at any point. And pretend we're just kind of sitting around having a beer, right? So tell us a story if you want to or whatever. And when I was a young guy in the 60s and early 70s, there was definitely a solid line between boys and girls. I don't mean I ever saw girls or women as inferior to men. I really didn't, but definitely as different. I never had girls as friends. They were either romantic partners or just acquaintances or schoolmates or work colleagues. And dates were almost always one-on-one. I have to admit that in one part of my mind, I always immediately assessed women in terms of their sexual attractiveness. I recognized and appreciated their intelligence or talent or style or personality. Honestly, that was secondary to me at that time to their sheer sex appeal. So what was that like with you guys? Let's see, Mike, I'll start with you.
No, I think by the 1980s, it changed quite a bit. We're the MTV generation before they came up with the Gen X, Gen Y thing. And so we had girls just want to have fun, and the boys just kind of went along with it. And so I think it was common for boys to see girls as somewhat equals, and dates were, could be groups of friends, and at lunch you could sit with girls and boys. It was pretty much intermixed. And especially when I got to college, I mean, of the 20 dorms in my college, I think 19 are all co-ed.
Yeah, that was definitely not the case. When I was in college, it was definitely different dorms. And it wasn't even different floors on the same dorm. It was different dorms, you know, and you would have like mixers where they'd get together and they were supervised and that kind of thing. So it was very different then. It was kind of like the same as it had been for the previous 30 years or more, I guess. So what about you, Spencer? I have an impression that by the time your group were teenagers, the sexes were even more blended than Mike was describing, and that you went out at night in mixed groups of boys and girls and, you know, maybe paired off sometimes, but were generally friends more than lovers, right? So is that impression correct for your younger, even
yes,
though you're 25, you know, but like, you know, 4, 5, 6, 8 years ago or whatever, was that pretty much the same?
I definitely think it's true. I think now, more with technology, people have been able to communicate faster, and the groups of boys and girls, they all have their own cliques, and they all know who that they want to talk to, so they really just kind of click up, and it's boys or girls. Maybe one group is only boys, maybe one group is only girls. It's really just kind of how you see yourself wanting to act socially.
But do the pairings occur out of the groups, or are they, because, you know, what I was describing with me, it was definitely you would single somebody out and then kind of hit on them. You know, it was never a group thing, at least in my experience, for anybody I knew. It was always like one-on-one. But in your group, did it arise out of groups?
I would definitely say it comes out of groups. Like, different groups will go out with other groups and they'll mingle. And I mean, of course, if you have boys and girls together, they're going to talk to each other and flirt and do whatever.
Right. Let's talk about like what you could call the sexual politics of it or whatever. In my group, it was, in my age group, it was definitely strong jealousies and competitiveness and so on about who was dating who and that kind of thing. And girls would be extremely upset with each other if they found they were dating the same guy and that kind of thing. But in groups, that's harder to disguise, right? So how does that dynamic work in the millennial Gen Y people?
I think our generation has really come to try to be in their own and understanding what they want. So some people might be super jealous and super overprotective, but then I think it's really leaning toward that people are trying to be more, in a sense, passive in their relationships, that they don't really want to cause waves. I mean, it's getting to a point where, like, if you're a meathead guy and you want to get with a girl and you're super controlling, the girls don't want that anymore. That's not what they're looking for.
A meathead. First, I thought you were talking about, and she was a vegetarian and you were a meathead.
No.
Guess not. But so it sounds like it's less less intense in a way. It sounds like romantic pairings are more like whatever, like hooking up rather than
intense one-on-one. I'd definitely say it's more
flingy
now.
That actually sounds better
for me. But I'd
say you
could definitely get away with a lot more when y'all were growing up, just because you didn't have phones to take pictures and locations and GPS.
Yeah, there was less communication about who was doing what with who, for sure. Yeah, and people didn't talk about it that much. I guess the girls talked about it more, but I learned early on, you don't talk about it. So what about you, Mike? Is it somewhat in the middle of what we were both describing, Spencer and I were describing?
Yeah, I think it's fair. From where I sit, I think it's almost closer to Spencer in some ways. I do think what women had evolved, and there was still competition. The meathead thing was there to some degree, and some girls liked that a little bit, but it was definitely changing. You could see there was basically a lot of different types, and it was all over the map. So it wasn't like one way or the other. It was somewhere in between.
So when I was a teenager in the mid-60s, especially in Central Florida, where I happened to be, and which was pretty much the Deep South then, the most important thing to girls was their reputation. I mean, they would never do anything that could lead to their being thought of as a bad girl, you know, and there was a worse term for it. But that was something that they avoided like the absolute plague. And that was a big barrier to overcome, right, for a long time. But I personally, you know, this is sounding, I don't know, sexist, I guess it is. What teenage boy is not sexist in some way? But I personally cracked the code by going to the next town up the road to date. And when I did that, it was like suddenly the world changed because I didn't know anyone they knew, and suddenly the inhibitions were out the window because I couldn't talk about them to anybody they knew. And like Spencer said, there were no cell phones or anything of the sort, no Facebook, no nothing, you know. So was that the same for you in the 80s, Mike, that reputation was a big deal, or was that less so?
I think it's interesting. It's a little bit of both. So I grew up in a very conservative area, so that was still frowned upon. Like I said, with the Madonna generation and MTV, there was definitely a group of girls who didn't care. So it was a little bit of a bounce. So some girls really did care, some didn't. And I'd say from the adults would always, you know, they were very conservative, so they would shun that. But for the boys, some boys cared, some didn't.
What about you, Spencer? Do girls care at all now about their reputation?
I definitely think that reputation has kind of changed from y'all's time, because now girls want to be seen as bad or doing whatever they want because they're empowered now. And that's part of their reputation, is that they want to be able to be seen as that they can do whatever they want to do because they can now. Really, they could before, but I think they're just now getting the feeling that they're really able to do exactly what they want to do, and they're really just kind of spreading their wings and blossoming as a gender, in a sense.
Wow.
Did you see a big difference, Spencer, difference between high school and college? Because to me, that's what was really stark. And I went to a college in a conservative area, but obviously I went to a mid-sized school with about 7,000 students, and a lot of the people came from a larger city, Philadelphia. And I met girls there that were very much liberated. and yet others who were very conservative. But in high school, because it was a smaller area, I think people tended to be more conservative and reserved and worry about reputation, to Court's point. But by college, it was the gamut.
Yeah, well, I grew up in a really small town where everyone literally knows everyone. So everyone does care about their reputation, but to a point, I think it's really gotten away from, like, what you're doing sexually, or, like, who you're with, or what that with. They're trying to get away from that as being a reputation factor.
Is reputation center more now, Spencer, on other things, like whether you're trustworthy or honest? And
I think it's just genuinely what kind of person you are, and really what social groups you are, and how you carry yourself, and what you do with your life. Like, if you're sitting at home doing nothing all day, like, you're probably not going to get that much respect from your peers or really anyone older than you. But if you're out working and trying your best, like, you're going to get that level of respect, and it's going to help build your reputation. It's not really looking at what you're doing outside of work.
Well, on the one hand, that sounds good. But, you know, since we're talking here about gender relations, you know, in my era, by the time I got to college, the sexual revolution was blossoming, which meant that girls were, for the first time at least, allowed to have sex without being, you know, without having to hide it so much. But it wasn't really overt. But it sounds to me like maybe what you're talking about, since they want to explore that more, it sounds like a second sexual revolution that's actually much more explosive a revolution than was experienced in the 60s. Is it like wide open where it's really easy now? I mean, since this is an NPR show, it's kind of a family show, but since we're talking a little frankly here about that aspect of life, is it very easy now? Because it was work when I was a kid.
I mean, no, I'd definitely say it's still work. It's what you go for. Like, there are definitely some girls you could get pretty easy, even there are some girls that you're going to have to marry and take care of and have a beautiful job and everything before you even get to get with them. It just really depends on the person now, I think. I think it depends on a lot how they were raised in their home life growing up.
One thing, too, is back then, kind of related to this, girls never initiated anything in a way that was at all obvious. We're talking about the, you know, mid-60s and that kind of period. So the guys always took the lead. But Mike, was it different by the 80s where girls would initiate a relationship?
So, yeah, the 80s, it was definitely a second revolution, I think. It was always work, depending on how you approach different individuals. If somebody was, like, more reserved, obviously you had to spend time. And if the women were more liberated, then obviously you didn't. And it just depended on the individual.
So, again, the late 60s, early 70s, you know, the period generally called the 60s, even though it kind of began in the mid-60s and ended in the early 70s. Changed everything. And when the baby boom, which was this big pig in the python of the U.S. population, got to college, at that time anyway, rock and roll and drugs combined with peer pressure to knock down the inhibitions that I was describing earlier and produce, you know, again, that first sexual revolution. But I have an idea that that happened at a much earlier age in succeeding generations. And it sounds like you're probably talking about it having happened earlier. Would you say, Spencer, we'll skip to you?
In a sense, what are you saying?
The kind of openness you were talking about sexually, where there were no real inhibitions.
Oh,
instead of that happening in college, it must have happened maybe in high school?
No, that has definitely changed. I mean, getting into our age, there are so many different genders now. And I've known people who have been in elementary school, and they know that they like boys or they like girls. And they're very open about that, or as some people are. They're very open about that. And I think the culture has become much more accepting of that.
Yeah, that's one thing that's extremely different now, because when I was a kid, it was very unusual for somebody to be gay. I mean, it was, you know, and it was obvious when they were, but now there's, you know, a gamut of, you know, the LGBTQI, I forget the rest of the acronym, but, you know, there are different kinds of gender identities, and that's talked about so openly as a normal thing. And that would have been, honestly, it's politically incorrect to even say, but in 1965, that would have been viewed as absolutely insane. You know, so that's a major change culturally. And I don't know to what extent it is, you know, we're getting into tricky territory here, but I don't know to what extent
it's
not tricky with you. I mean, with our listeners, but anyway,
but
it's imposed partly by media, you know, and then partly by just the mainstreaming of those things. And, you know, who knows how much of it was just in the closet and or even unrecognized, you know, 50 years ago, but that's a major, major change in gender relations, because suddenly instead of just two genders, there are multiple versions and permutations of genders. So how do you deal with that, Spencer?
Honestly, I do not care. You can do whatever you want to do around me as long as you're not hurting anyone or hurting yourself, honestly. I have plenty of LGBTQ friends, and I honestly don't look at them any different than I look at anyone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a big difference. I mean, that's a huge cultural difference. This is one of the biggest cultural differences in the last 50 years, I would say. Would you agree, Mike?
Oh, definitely. I would say in the 80s, the LNG were just coming into their own, where it was starting to be somewhat accepted. Then mm-hmm. I think you also have to remember that happened at the same time as the AIDS epidemic. Mm-hmm. And I think that really hurt a lot of things, especially more for gay men. And I remember like people coming out, and it's like people wanted to say, hey, this is new, this is cool, we can accept you. But then with the 80s and the trauma of the AIDS, people, you know, when it first came out, you didn't even know if you could shake their hand.
Yeah,
and,
that's
and
right.
So I think that stalled the movement a little bit. But by the mid-90s, when I was in college, it was almost, I wouldn't say hip yet, but it was definitely accepted.
Yeah, and Spencer's saying it's actually hip now. It's more like you're boring if you're just old white bread vanilla.
Yeah, and we talked about this at work the other day, actually, how there's so much influence from social media on kids that they might have a favorite person on YouTube or someone that they watch every day, and they might be gay, and they might just assume that they're gay because they like that person, because they're so young that they really don't know any better. And I mean, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but it's definitely very influential.
Yeah, the media have a big influence on that. If you watch commercials, it's, you know, we watch International House Hunters, and I'd say at least half the couples are gay on International House Hunters, and I pretty much doubt that half the couples in the United States are gay. So anyway. Well, what about, you know, one last thing here before we leave and go to our next topic. How about marriage? Is it becoming obsolete, or is it here to stay? Either of you, jump in.
I hope that it's here to stay. I would love to get married and have someone take care of me and me take care of them and have a happy family and everything. Like, I think that's the dream, honestly. But as I've been growing up, marriages definitely seem to be shambly. They definitely seem to not work out. Most people date somebody for 2 years, married for 5, have 2 kids, divorced, hate each other, get married again, like... It's a vicious cycle, and I don't want to be a part of that cycle, but at this point, I mean, what, half of the marriages fail now?
Sorry, I was going to say in the 80s, it was, I think things definitely shifted a little bit. I don't think marriage died. I think people just became more cautious. I know my parents and their generation being boomers, it was weird. I mean, my father would say half his class got married within a year of graduating high school, and a lot of that was due to socioeconomics. And my father could go and get a job at one company, and if he didn't like it, he could have a job by the end of the day at another company. And late 80s and 90s, you know, it was the economy had finally picked up and gotten a little better, but it wasn't perfect. And so I think people still got married, but I think it was delayed. So I think the average age in my group was with college, you know, you got married a year or two after college. So instead of getting married at 18, 19, 23, 24 was more common. And getting pushed, and I'm just wondering, Spencer's generation, if that's going to get pushed out even further.
Mm-hmm.
I'm planning on getting married around when I'm 30. I think that's a good age, because I think I'll have matured enough to understand what I want for the rest of my life, or hopefully I have, or, I mean, that's all speculative, well, of course, but...
Yeah, you're planning on getting married at 30. That presupposes a lot of things,
30-ish,
right?
30-ish.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that wouldn't be much later than it has been common for the past 25 years or so. I mean, when I was young, you know, my parents were pretty much the normal profile at the time. I mean, my dad got out of World War II and got a college degree in engineering, and he was 24 when my parents got married, and she was 19. She was still in college, and so she dropped out of college to marry him, and that was a very common process, or, you know, a profile at the time. And that was actually joked about as calling the MRS degree, you know, because you dropped out of college to become a Mrs. somebody or other. But I think that definitely was out the window for most people by the 80s, and certainly by now it is. But
I think that's changed a lot, just because when you were growing up, you had breadwinners. Like, the majority of the money in the household was coming from the man. And most of the time, the wife would stay home and take care of the kids. And now, it's both parents have to work. Both parents have to do equal roles. They have to do the laundry. They have to clean. They have to cook. And I think that's really changed how marriage is viewed, because it's, I'd say it's more of a friendship thing now, more than like what you get from it. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah, and that's good actually. Yeah, it's less a contract that's based on need and dependency. So that's a good thing.
Exactly.
Well, you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with three of us, actually, about the differences between three generations. I'm a baby boomer, and we're talking with Mike Stump, who is a member of the, let's see if I remember it right, the Gen X division. So he's in his mid-40s. And then we're talking with Spencer Necessary, who is at the tail end of Gen Y, which was the millennials. And he was born, I guess, in 1996 and is 25. So he's an older... You're 24?
Okay. Yeah.
But you're still at the older end of Gen Y, and then there are Gen Zs who are too young to be on this show. But they're home in bed. But anyway, so let's switch now to communication styles, and we don't have that much time to talk about it because we enjoyed ourselves reveling in the gender relations part of it. But when I was a kid, there was in-person conversation, and there was phone, and occasionally written letters, and that was it. I mean, communication was stilted and very limited, and a long-distance phone call, depending on where you were calling, cost something like 35 cents a minute, and that's the equivalent of maybe $4 or $5 a minute today, so you can imagine how that cut back on long-distance calling. So really, communication was mostly limited to the people around you. Long-distance phone began to get cheaper in the early 80s, and internet chat rooms first appeared in the mid to late 80s, but they were limited mainly to geeky guys who are tech people, and email began to catch on in the early 90s and the web in the mid-90s, but it all exploded probably in the late 90s. So, Mike, what's your recollection of all that and its impact on communication with people?
Yeah, definitely. I would say everything was pretty much on the phone by the time I grew up. I think letters were still there as I was a kid. I remember having pen pals, you know, to write to other kids in other countries, but that was the only time I really wrote a letter. If I wanted to talk to my grandparents who lived out west, we always got on the phone and talked to them. But you're right about the pricing. I remember it was almost a dollar a minute in the late 70s, early 80s, because I remember having very hurried conversations like, hey, say hi real quick. And you got like 3-4 minutes and that was it.
Yeah, there were certain times of day when it was cheaper. So you'd call before, you know, if you initiated the call before 7 a.m., it was a lot cheaper than 1 minute later or something like that. So it's crazy. But for a long time, for boomers, email was the new thing, right? So in the, early 90s when email began to be prevalent, email was a big deal. And texting was really avant-garde by the, late 90s, or, you know, really by the early 2000s even. So, but especially by the early 2000s, with the emergence of smartphones, young kids were getting buried in their phones and texting constantly, you know, that phenomenon you see today where they won't lift their heads up and they're texting the person sitting next to them or whatever. But I think now even texting is passe for Gen Y millennials. I mean, there's Twitter and Snapchat and WhatsApp and others I probably don't even know about. So, Spencer, what communication tools do you use and how do you use them?
So I do text. I use Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, WhatsApp. Those are really the main ones. I have Facebook, but I never get on it.
Have you ever used Tinder?
Yeah. I'd say pretty much everyone in my age group has.
And so who do you communicate with mostly? I mean, the same people that you communicate with in every other way, or is it different groups
mostly,
for different apps?
I have, like on Snapchat, I have groups of my friends that I grew up with, and we're in a group, and we send messages to each other all day long, and we just talk and shoot the crap. So we really use, like I use my, as texting is different, like texting is more formal for me. Snapchat is more... if I want to send you something funny, like a picture of me, or if I have something to say to you that I don't necessarily want it to stay on your phone forever, I might send you a Snapchat because I know it's going to go away. Or if I wanted to post a picture that I necessarily didn't want to post on Facebook, I would post it on Instagram because it's more my age group. Mm-hmm. When I start moving into Facebook, it's when it gets scary because it's all my parents or my dad's friends and my mom's old friends. Yeah. And really, I can't say anything on there without getting torn apart. I remember I used to post on Facebook when I was in middle school, and I'd come home and my parents would yell at me. They'd be like, why'd you post that? Somebody said something about it. I was like, why? Why do they care that much? So then I moved to Twitter, and I'd be saying whatever I wanted to because that's my age group, and some random old person would get Twitter and follow me and then call my dad and tell them what I'm saying on Twitter, and it's like... So it's like, really, you're just kind of, you know what your app you're using to not necessarily cover your tracks. That sounds sneaky, but you're just using it for,
in a tailored
manner. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
So it seems like you have to actually think about where to post if you have something you want to post before you actually post it.
Oh, definitely. I do. Some people don't. Some people don't care. That goes along with the liberation thing earlier. People really are doing whatever they want, but I want to keep my reputation as intact as I can while still putting out just social media posts. Yeah,
who
I am.
You want to be what you are. So, yeah, it sounds like you can easily get burned on Facebook, so you're probably wary of it, and it's probably uncool for most people your age, I would think, for that reason.
Yeah, I don't even have it downloaded on my phone. But see, like, some of my friends are super into Facebook. It really is just who you are. Like, some of my friends don't have social media. Sometimes I delete my social media.
Well, Court, I'm going to push the question back to you because as an Xer, I don't know if I'm odd or not, but I never did Facebook, Twitter, any of it. But I know people that are just 2 or 3 years younger, that's when it became a thing. So, like, if I go to my high school and look at the 100-odd people I graduate with, I cheat with my wife's account because she's got Facebook, and I'll see, like, maybe 8 or 10 people out of 120 that are on Facebook ever. But then if I go 2 or 3 years younger, it's like 50-50. And then, you know, 5 years after that, it's almost everybody. So is the boomers use social media, or how does that work?
I think older people, for the most part, boomers are on Facebook a lot. I have Facebook accounts for myself and my company and my radio show. The same with Twitter accounts. I never use them. I have them just basically defensively so that somebody else doesn't take them over. But, you know, I get those accounts, but there's nothing on them. I have LinkedIn, and to some extent I use that. I don't use it actively, but, you know, I have a lot of LinkedIn contacts and people will connect with me sometimes through that. But, you know, but I have those accounts. I don't use them. But I'm unusual in that regard. And, you know, who knows? I mean, we can speculate. I think more women than men use Facebook, but certainly a lot of men use Facebook. You know, again, we're talking about the baby boomer generation. So we're getting to the end of the show, and I wish we had more time here, but we can push some of this into the next show we're going to do next week on these kinds of topics. And maybe we'll pick that up because we pretty much are at the end of this show in terms of time. But I don't know. Let me ask just one last question. So, Spencer, are you happy being the age you are? I mean, do you look back at previous generations and wish you were born then?
I'm going to be honest. I really wish I was a flower child in the 60s. That's just who I am. I would have loved to be there, spread love and peace, and then grow up and see the 70s and the 80s, and then come to the 90s and really see technology take off. I think that would have been a wild ride, honestly.
It was, believe me. So what about you, Mike? Are you happy in the generation you're in?
Very much so. I couldn't ask for anything better. I mean, growing up in the 80s with everything and watching technology, to Spencer's point, I remember getting on CompuServe on the internet in 1982. Of course, it looks very different than what it did today, but we got to experience the whole technology boom and just kind of everything. It was a lot of fun.
Again, next week will be more of the three of us talking about things from the perspective of three generations, and we'll talk about attitudes toward work and career, and also our differing views on what the future looks like. I want to thank all of you for listening, and thank you guys in particular for being on with us. So,
thanks, Court. Thanks, Spencer.
Thank you for having us. Thank you, Mike.
So if you enjoyed this conversation with the three of us, tres amigos, tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.